I speak to Aleph Farms' co-founder and CEO Didier Toubière about plans to launch its cultivated beef cuts across jurisdictions, expecting approval in a second jurisdiction in the next couple of months. Whether that's Singapore, Switzerland, the UK or Thailand is your guess. But having secured approval from Israel's Ministry of Health last year for their Aleph cuts, they are now focused on Southeast Asia with a plan to launch early in 2026 with the help of a new factory established in Thailand. Listen to find out how they've reduced production costs by 97%. I'm Alex Crisp and welcome to another episode of Future of Foods Interviews. All episodes available on Spotify and all podcast channels and on YouTube and Substack. Okay, so thank you very much to Didier Toubière, who is CEO and co-founder of Aleph Farms, based in Israel, produce cultivated beef. And Aleph were given regulatory approval a year ago to sell cultivated beef in Israel. And you are still awaiting approval for in several other jurisdictions, including UK, Singapore, USA, Switzerland, and now Thailand. So 1 year on, Didier, since you were given approval, what are the major differences that you've noticed? What are some of those big changes that you've seen since you got approval in Israel?
Yes. Hello, Alex, and hello, everyone. Thanks for having me again. Yes, first, we do see, the global and the worldwide trends, which are really supporting the diversification of the animal protein categories, which remain very important to us, and we haven't seen any change in the long-term trends. As you might know, today 30% of the Europeans, 28% of the Asians consider themselves as flexitarians, meaning eating meat, but looking at ways to diversify the protein intake and reduce the meat consumption due to ethical, health, or environmental reasons. And cultivated meat, as you know, which is our first product, is a new animal protein category, which is actually meeting those expectations for a more sustainable and a healthier and delicious new experience, which we can actually deliver to the diners globally. It's based on cultivating the cells of the animals directly instead of farming the whole animal, slaughtering them, and then harvesting meat from their carcass. We're able to directly grow the edible part of the animal, the interesting products whole body. So the trends remain here and remain strong. I think that on Aleph Farms' side, what we've really achieved in the last 1-2 years is, on one hand, as you mentioned, the first regulatory approval, which is really mitigating the risk of not being able to launch any product. You know, as you know, those technologies are relatively innovative. We're talking about a new category, which is considered a novel food in many countries. So the fact we got the first approval demonstrates that our technology is safe and our products meet all the strictest requirements in terms of food safety. And we expect to get at least one additional approval in another country in the next couple of months. So stay tuned. In parallel, we've also done a lot of work on optimizing our production process. We just completed at the end of 2024 a 2 years plus R&D plan to further reduce our production costs by an astonishing 97%, which is really a huge achievement of our team. We're currently in the process of validating this full optimized process, which does rely on the same technologies, meaning we don't see any regulatory hurdles or barrier for launching this optimized process. We're just in the process in the phase now of validating it, and we should start moving it into our pilot plant during the course of 2025. In parallel, we've done a lot of work and making sure that our product would fit the market expectations through studies and workshops with the chefs and customers in different countries, in Europe, in Israel, in Asia. And we have secured four initial commercial agreements in 2024, one in Israel, one in Europe, and two in Asia. Which is really important for us in order to de-risk the market risk and to make sure that we can rely on a wide ecosystem in order to drive our product into the market and drive impact on the short, mid, and long term. And last but not least, we've done a lot of work to address the scale-up challenges for the company. And signing an agreement with a consortium in Asia to set up a production facility in Southeast Asia, and working currently with other partners in different parts of Europe, in Switzerland, in the UK, and identifying other facilities where we could scale up our process without investing significant capital expenditures. We're really working on an asset light and a very efficient way to scale up our process. So, and this is important in terms of mitigating the financial risk of scaling up the business. So, you know, a lot of progress on many different fronts. Regarding our launch, we decided mid-2024 to postpone our launch until we do implement our new optimized production process. And again, we should transfer it into production during the course of 2025. So we're currently targeting the end of 2025 for launching our product. It's important for us to launch a product which is not just a great product, but also which is a profitable product. And I think that the times where companies were rushing to launch products at small scale, which were very expensive to make, and where did not make sense economically speaking, are gone. I think that both companies, investors, stakeholders in the industry today are really willing to see a clear path to break even and profitability.
Yes. So you were saying that you are expecting to get some further regulatory approval in the next couple of months. So I suppose when you launch your product, you're hoping to launch it in at least two jurisdictions at the same time. Obviously, that's more effective as a launch than just launching it in one place. So I know that you applied for a regulatory approval in the UK, Switzerland, and Israel all at the same time, didn't you? So obviously, Israel gave approval much quicker than the other two. Why do you think, I mean, do you think Switzerland and the UK are slow, or is it that Israel was particularly quick in giving approval?
Yeah, so first we filed in Israel and in Singapore before we filed in the UK and Switzerland. We filed in the UK and Switzerland a year later. I think that we've made good progress in those two additional countries. It's clear that we've been the first company to apply for any cultivated meat products in those jurisdictions, meaning that it's clear that those bodies needed to go through some initial learning curve in order to be able, you know, to assess this type of application, and it's taking, you know, some time for the first review always. But I think we're making good progress. Overall, there is you know, strong alignment between what we do and the goals of countries like the UK, Switzerland, for promoting innovation, for driving a sustainable transition of the economy, for improving public health, reducing the use of antibiotics, solving some demographic issues with animal agriculture. So overall, there's a strong interest, and I do believe that those two countries represent an interesting opportunity to drive impact and reach significant revenues.
Yes, I mean clearly you have your goals set on Asia with Thailand facility and also applying for permission there and also in Singapore. I mean, did you have your eyes set on anywhere else such as Hong Kong? I know that Val had some kind of dalliance in Hong Kong at the end of last year.
Yes, we've looked at Hong Kong as well. The reason why we decided approximately 2 years ago to really focus on Asia, on the wider APAC region first, it's actually a couple of reasons. The first one is that Aleph Farms has a strong emphasis on food security, meaning promoting new ways to make animal products which could be decentralized, meaning better distributed, including in regions of the world where the climate, the availability of land, water do not allow for a large scale cattle farming, which is the case in many Asian countries, but also in the Middle East and North Africa. And I think in those countries, there is a strong alignment with the governments and the overall animal protein ecosystem for promoting new approaches such as cultivated meat. In those countries, the beef is usually imported, meaning that its selling price is usually higher as well. So even though some countries are smaller, will anyway have smaller quantities when we launch, so we'll not be limited by the size of the country for the first let's say a couple of years of commercialization anyway, and with better focus on maximizing the pricing and the gross margin to reach breakeven quicker. And so I think that those countries are interesting. The expected acceptance of cultivated meat in many Asian countries is very high, as high as 90, 93, even 97% in Thailand. And I think that the openness of the wider population to new foods and the creativity of the culinary scene in those countries is impressive. And there's also a lot of focus on food safety and the traceability of the supply chain. And of course, a lot of record of eating complementary proteins and other proteins than just beef and meat. So I think that those are interesting geographies. Of course, we do look at EMEA as an important geography as well, and we do have plans for coming back to the US in the next couple of years. We decided to pause a bit our efforts to launch in the US 2 years ago, and we'll probably come back to the US in the next, let's say, a couple of years. We do see the US on the longer term as a strategic market as well. In parallel, we're also developing strategies for the Global South. We published 6 months ago an article which had a lot of echo actually in the ecosystem about strategies for leapfrogging intensive agriculture in continents like Africa and move directly toward the next generation of complementary proteins, which is an opportunity for Africa, for instance, to lead and actually to avoid the pitfalls of intensive agriculture as we've seen it in as we have seen them in the global north. So we were really trying to implement stage by stage a relatively global strategy and being a relevant solution for the global food system, and not only for, let's say, the elite in New York or London.
Yes, I mean it's a massive job to do, isn't it? When you look at it like that, it's like inventing a whole new food system, kind of globally, all in one go. It's a lot to undertake. You said that you've re reduced your production cost by 74%, did you?
By 97%.
97%, sorry. So how have you managed to do that?
Yeah, first, this huge achievement is the result of over 2 years of development. So it has been an extensive effort in which we invested significant resources. It hasn't occurred overnight, and we approached the production cost from different angles. One angle is, of course, the optimization of the feedstock of the cells, what is called the growth medium. We have actually removed all the expensive ingredients of this formulation and reduced the inclusion rate of other components and optimized the formulation for cost and yield. But we've also been able to ensure 100% use of all the ingredients which we have in there in order to avoid waste and reduce the cost there as well. And in parallel, we have optimized the production process itself, meaning we have shortened the cultivation time, increased the yield. We have removed a lot of the dedicated equipment we had in the original process, in order to make the process more scalable and reduce the investment in equipment. Last but not least, we also improved the end product. So we really looked at this process from all its aspects, the optimizing the inputs, optimizing the yield and the actual efficiency of the cell cultivation without any genetic engineering. And we also looked at the end product and optimized the whole system in a holistic manner.
Right. So you have altered the growth media. I'm assuming then that you are no longer using a bovine serum as part of the media. Is that right?
That's right. We've been using what we call an animal component-free growth medium, meaning without any fetal bovine serum and without any other animal components for at least 4 years, 4 or 5 years already. So
Okay.
for a long time, and that's correct.
So does this mean that your cultivated meat is virtually kind of vegetarian as a food?
That's a good question. Our first product, by the way, is a hybrid product, meaning that we incorporate animal cells into a plant-based matrix. So it has animal cells and plant components. The cells we use are sourced from animals, meaning that our product wouldn't be, let's say, vegan, but many vegetarians would use it, as of course it's avoiding any animal suffering. It has a much smaller environmental impact and is also optimized for nutrition, meaning potentially healthy and providing high protein intake. It's low in calories and saturated fat, high in iron, vitamin B12. So, a lot of vegetarians actually, I mean, all the vegetarians who've been talking to would consume our products. Even through vegetarians are not the our primary target.
No.
We do expect meat eaters to be our early adopters.
Yes. And the cells themselves, I remember that one of the American companies, I'm not sure if it was kind of, if it was Eat Just, they said that they took their cells from a chicken feather, and then through and then through and then through genetic engineering, they were able to sort of make it, into a cell that can reproduce. I mean, is this a method that you've, how, where do your cells come from on the animal, I suppose, is the question.
So we use a bovine cells, meaning beef cells, and not chicken cells. Alfarm focus on high value, high impact products for the next few years. Meaning we're not making a cultivated chicken. We might in the future, of course, but we
Well,
believe
yes,
that.
I wasn't proposing that you made a cell cultivated chicken. It's just that they took because they said that they took the cells from a feather, so the chicken wasn't harmed in any way,
Exactly.
and then that cell was manipulated. I was just wondering how you take your cells from the cow.
Yeah, so we take our cells from what is called fertilized eggs, like fertilized ovules, which is just after the insemination of an ovule. We were able to isolate the very first cells, which divide the first tens of cells
Okay.
before they start turning into any organism. And those cells are called pluripotent cells, and they can actually replicate in theory forever without the need for any genetic manipulation. So, and the difference to our peers, we don't incorporate any gene editing, gene engineering, nor what is called immortalization, which is another way to select specific clones of cells. We don't do that neither. We use cells which have the natural genetic material and which are equivalent to the same cells we can find in our steaks today.
Okay. And so those cells that you take, obviously they have a life cycle, I suppose, don't they? So you can't use them forever. They have to be replaced. So
So this specific type of cells can be used for a very, very long time. They don't have this senescence effect, which you can find in the cells which are isolated from the body of an adult animal. So we can actually build a very efficient large scale production infrastructure based on those cells without the need for manipulating them.
okay. All right. Very, very interesting. So I also wanted to ask you touched on financing earlier, how it's been quite a difficult climate, I suppose, recently, hasn't it? The last couple of years. How have you managed this kind of complicated time? Have you had any trouble raising funds or yes.
So we've been quite lucky on one hand, as we have strong partners and we've been able to raise some money in the last couple of years. On the other hand, it's true that the funding environment is much more challenging than it was in 2021, for instance. 2021 was an outlier. I think that it was money was easily accessible, interest rates were very, very low, and investors were pouring a lot of money at early stage companies to increase the risk and maximize the return.
It also increased the hype, I suppose, didn't it? Because there was so much money.
Yes, you're right. I think that there had been kind of a hype, or even we can say a bubble in 2021. We're today back to normal times, so I would say, with the higher interest rates and investors refocusing on economic fundamentals like profitability and scalability. And of course, it has an impact on all the companies in the space, including on Alephans, but I think it's a positive impact. It pushed us for being very focused on launching this first product and showing our ability to reach breakeven with this first product. And I think it forced us to be very disciplined and to be very clear about our objective or purpose and very strict about resource allocation. And I think that the companies which can, on one hand, validate their product market fit and the need for their product, but also on the other hand, demonstrate the ability to make money and to drive profits on the short term, will be able to raise money. Investors today are not investing in the food system transformation as a general idea. They really want to invest in practical products which can drive acceptance and make money.
Yeah.
So we need to kind of switch, you know, little bit the angle and make sure that that's what we deliver.
I mean, it's a very expensive business, isn't it? I mean, clearly the kind of production is expensive, and but also the kind of regulatory kind of landscape is quite expensive. And I suppose you have stretched further than a lot of companies in that you have kind of dipped your toe into quite a few different jurisdictions. I suppose this has been quite a complicated process to try Switzerland and the USA and England and Singapore and all of these places. Have you found that the landscape kind of differs significantly in all these places?
Yes, it does. And first, you're right. You know, because investors are really, you know, back to the, you know, to the fundamentals, they're also looking for companies which present a lower risk. I think that you know, the companies which can show that they have mitigated the regulatory risk, that they're also not putting all their eggs in the same basket and developing, you know, plans for different geographies. And have this flexibility we have, but also have demonstrated their ability to drive their costs down and to drive positive margins with a good product, and will have more chances to raise money. I think that the another barrier for raising money in the food technology industries in general is the CapEx requirements. A lot of companies in our space, including cultivated meat companies, require significant resources to scale up. And I think that our ability to develop an asset-light roadmap for scaling up our production have been also instrumental in our ability to adjust to the evolving market environments. And to your point, yes, I think that the market opportunity for cultivated meat in Switzerland is very different, very different from the UK and very different from Singapore. What is unique about food is that food is not a functional product. Food is really a cultural product. Food is about culture. Food is an emotional product. You know, people do connect with their food. In a way that don't connect with other products. Food activates, you know, specific areas in the brain and has a social role. It's connected to the roots of the people and to the identity of the people much more than any other product. So we need to make sure that when we develop a novel production process or novel ingredient in food, it is culturally relevant, not just relevant in terms of, let's say, you know, greenhouse gases or saving water and land. It does not matter in the market. For a product to be successful in the market, it needs to be culturally relevant. And we're doing a lot of work on this aspect.
I remember when you announced that you had applied for a regulatory approval in Switzerland, and I think you were probably the first company to do that. And I wondered then why you chose Switzerland rather than kind of Europe as a whole. I mean, I suppose if you're in Switzerland, you can then sort of sell in Europe, and perhaps it's easier to get permission in Switzerland. Was that the thinking?
You're right. First, we're also planning to file our regulatory application in Europe at some point in time. We just thought that starting with smaller countries with a more focused approach could be more efficient to start with, as opposed to file directly in Europe, which is a large geography but has a more complex regulatory process just because it requires a lot of coordination between the countries. As you know, in Europe, the regulatory approval is in two stages. The first stage is the safety assessment by EFSA, but then you need any
Need
new product to
specification.
be approved by a committee, the PAF committee, which is composed of representatives of the agricultural ministries of all the member states. And you need actually countries representing 60% of the overall European population to approve a new product. So
Yes.
there's a lot of let's say politics and interest involved in the regulatory process. So we said, let's start with smaller countries with a simpler process. Let's get cleared quicker. Let's start selling and then we can expand.
Okay, and have you found Switzerland easier to deal with? Was that a difficult question to answer?
I don't think that Switzerland is easier in terms of requirements. Switzerland, same as the UK, by the way, do rely on the European directives, and the law in Switzerland is aligned with the law in the EU, so the requirements are the same. On the other hand, I think that it's probably easier to manage the process in a more focused manner, and there is probably less politics involved, which is
Yeah.
also important.
Well, I think the politics is important, and you mentioned earlier that kind of food is also quite an emotive thing for the public, and this is part of why you've kind of chosen the jurisdictions you have. I mean, kind of in Asia, you think that they will be more open to this sort of food, this food evolution or food revolution or whatever we want to call it. You think they're probably more open there to maybe in the USA or in the UK?
Yes, but first, most of the countries in the world today are promoting innovation and are endorsing novel foods and cultivated meat in particular, including in the US. And the European Union is also, looking positively at cultivated meat as an addition and as a way to diversify the supply chain for animal proteins. In Europe, we do see a difference between the southern part of Europe. Around Italy, for instance, but also Romania and to a certain extent some parts in France, which usually have a more, let's say, rooted traditional agriculture. And the central and northern part of Europe, starting with Germany, which is endorsing very proactively cultivated meat and alternative proteins. The Netherlands, the UK, which is also pushing in this direction, and the Nordic countries, which are also very proactive with the climate transition and the sustainable transition of their economy. I think that in Europe, so overall the sentiment is positive, but there are some pockets of resistance. I think that those concerns of some of the lobbies are really motivated by financial interests. There are a lot of subsidies in Europe, tens of billions of dollars, which are poured at farmers and a lot of livestock farmers as well.
Yes.
In France, for instance, 53% of the livestock farms are technically bankrupted and artificially sustained in activity by subsidies. So I think that a lot of livestock farmers are concerned that if there are new ways to make animal proteins, there might be less incentives to continue and support them and fund them. So there are a lot of financial interests and subsidies at play,
Yeah.
which make it more complicated.
So they're afraid that they will lose their subsidies. And I guess this is the same in the USA, perhaps even more so in the USA. But I think coming back to sort of the politics and the emotions behind it. I mean, these meat lobbies, I suppose, they also have a lot of influence in the media, don't they? We kind of see quite a few articles recently over the last few years, especially in I mean, in the UK, in certain types of newspaper like the sort of Telegraph and the Daily Mail, have kind of have sort of said that plant-based food, for example, is bad for your health, because it's ultra processed, and they are certainly very much against sort of cultivated meats, anything which seems to threaten the meat industry. And it seems that there isn't a good media response to this, perhaps, that maybe there should be more effort put into to trying to explain what cultivated meat is and precision fermentation, and perhaps try and bring people round to a more positive way of looking at it.
Yeah, I think that the what a lot of stakeholders don't necessarily understand or don't want to understand is that we don't see cultivated meat or those new production systems as necessarily the end of animal agriculture. The idea is really to diversify our protein industry. And to provide additional choices and additional solutions to optimize the system as a whole. I think that today there are a lot of challenges in animal agriculture with the cost of feed, the cost of land, the demographic issues. A lot of livestock farmers today are close to retirement, and we don't see the new generation really stepping in and taking over the farms and continuing the livestock farming activity of their parents. With climate change and heat waves, extreme weather events, we do see a lot of stress on our ability to continue and produce quality meat in the quantities we need. And France, for instance, which has been a large beef producer, traditionally became a net importer of beef in the last 5 years. And the number of cattle heads is going down every year by 2% in the country. So we do see some real challenges, structural challenges in animal production. And I think that it is important even for the beef producing countries to prepare the future and to incorporate new solutions to diversify the production systems. And make sure that they build a resilient, high quality food production system for the future generations as well.
And clearly Israel is at the forefront of this sort of technology. It's, you have in that whole area around Rehovot, you have so many companies in this space. Why do you think Israel is kind of so pioneering in this space?
Israel has been always innovating in agriculture and food production just because the resources the country has are very limited. The climate is hostile. Large part of the country is a desert, and we're lacking water. Water is expensive. We're not doing desalinization of water. But still, resources are relatively expensive and scarce. And so the country has always been trying to push the frontier of what is possible to do with limited land availability, with less water, like drip irrigation, for instance, like controlled environment agriculture, which has been developed very strongly in Israel very early on. Like irrigation with salted water or the use of gray water in agriculture, but also adapting a lot of crops or plants to arid lands. So Israel has always been at the forefront of this type of innovation by necessity. And I think that the innovation which we see today in what we call the complementary protein sector, including cultivated meat, is really in line with this long-term trend for Israel to lead new production systems in agriculture, just by necessity. And we do see actually those constraints being shared with a lot of Israel neighbors in the Middle East and North Africa, and also in Asia. And today we're backed by three states. Aleph Farms is backed by the state of Israel, but also by the state of the UAE through the investment of a sovereign wealth fund, ADQ, in 2021, which is actually public money. We're also backed by Temasek, which is also a sovereign wealth fund from Singapore, which is also public money. And those three states are actually supporting what we do from the angle of food sovereignty, meaning being able to produce locally high quality animal proteins in an environment which is hostile to cattle farming. And we do believe actually that collaboration around food sovereignty and what we call food security issues in the Middle East will help rebuilding a better Middle East after the war, which I hope is ending, and addressing joint issues with through collaborations between Israel and its neighbors will be a way to better integrate the economies and to stabilize the Middle East through the Abraham Accords and other bilateral agreements, and will be a way to stabilize the region and to promote peace over the long term. So we do believe that Aleph Farms, beyond providing a healthy and sustainable transition of the food system, could also contribute
Help
to peace in the world.
unite the Middle East a little bit.
Exactly. I really believe in it.
Well, that's wonderful. I mean, but you haven't applied for permission in any of the Middle Eastern states, like in Qatar and places like that.
Yes, so we're currently in the process of preparing for filing in the UAE. The UAE was actually developing a framework for cultivated meat in the last couple of years. And now they're actually converging toward a type of framework which makes sense. And so we're working on it.
Okay, great. I wanted to ask one more question before I let you go. I heard in a podcast that you did, you were comparing cultivated meat industry to electric vehicles. And that made me it made me wonder whether what the industry needs is one kind of pioneering individual, the likes of Elon Musk, who can push this forward. Because I suppose part of what limits the growth is that people aren't sharing IP. And if there was one big company kind of pushing it forward, then that wouldn't be so much of a problem. Do you think that's relevant?
I think it is. I think it is relevant. You're right. The analogy I made at the time, I think, was from the angle of cultivated meat being a new category within an existing industry and not necessarily a one-to-one equivalent product, and also the need to drive this category through public-private partnerships and to make sure that we align the incentives of all the stakeholders in this industry to make it happen, same as it was the case in the electric vehicles. To your point, yes, I think you're right. We, at the end of the day, we to build new categories, many times leaders and individuals who have the vision and can drive lead this new category and the change have a role. You're right.
One last thing before we go. I know the area where you are. I'm not sure whether you're in Rehovot now, are you? You are.
I am.
That's when I was 18, I went to Kibbutz Shila, and I was there for 6 months as a volunteer. So I know Rehovot quite well. So it's kind of interesting to me that so many of the companies are around that area. It's a nice part of the world. But thank you, Didier, for your time and for coming on Future of Foods. It's been a fascinating conversation. I feel like I could ask you a lot more questions, but I don't want to sort of take up your whole day.
So thank you, Alex.
I'll certainly be following progress, and perhaps we'll meet at at some event at some point. I look forward to it.
Happy to.
All
Thank
right.
you and bon appétit.